This is the IBJ Podcast. For the week of February 15th, 2021, I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. It's not unusual for there to be some tension between state legislatures and the local officials who govern a state's biggest cities. They often have different perspectives on how to deal with big problems. I used to live up in Chicago, and the state lawmakers in Springfield, Illinois, often gave Chicago a chilly reception when city leaders came looking for assistance on some element of state government that intersected with the city. I would say that the relationship has been a bit more cordial between the Indiana legislature and the city of Indianapolis. In recent years, a trend has been developing nationwide in which state legislatures try to exert more control on their biggest cities and or weaken the authority of local government. As a matter of fact, just a week ago, Governing Magazine ran a major analysis piece on this trend, and the relationship between Indianapolis and the Indiana General Assembly was one of its prime examples. Indeed, a flurry of bills affecting local control is advancing in the legislature. One would shift oversight of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department from the mayor to a new five-member board that would be mostly appointed by the governor. Another bill would strip state funding for local public transportation and prevent Indigo from moving forward with its planned expansion of bus rapid transit lines. One would take zoning control away from city planners and give more power to townships in Marion County. Another bill would prevent the city from changing its name, even though there's been no proposal to do so. Local authorities see this as an extraordinary intrusion, and many of Central Indiana's largest employers agree. Last week, more than 60 business and not-for-profit executives issued an open letter to legislators warning them that this level of interference threatens to blunt the city's economic recovery. The amount of clout on the signature line of this letter is impossible to ignore. The signees include executives of nearly every major indie area company: Anthem, Eli Lilly and Company, One America, IU Health, Allison Transmission, Corteva, Cummins, Elanco Animal Health, Salesforce, Roche Diagnostics, United Way of Central Indiana. If you've got your name on a building, you're probably on this list. For the podcast, we wanted to learn more about how this concerted effort came about. The economic argument the businesses are making against legislative intrusion, and what might happen if they can't come to an understanding with legislators. Our guests today are Michael Huber, CEO of the Indy Chamber, who signed the letter and whose organization helped coordinate this effort, and Amon Brar, CEO of tech firm JobVite, who also signed the letter. Here's our conversation. Here with us to discuss the letter to the legislature is Michael Huber, the president and CEO of the Indy Chamber. Michael, thank you for making time.
Thank you, Mason. It's good to be here.
And we're also joined by one of the CEOs who signed the letter. It's Amon Brar. He's the CEO of JobVite, which is a software and recruiting company that helps clients find, hire, and onboard new employees. He also was the president of Indianapolis-based Apparatus, a tech firm that was acquired in 2015 by a Massachusetts-based public company. Amon, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Mason. Thanks.
So let's just jump into it. So here we have a coordinated response to a critical mass of legislation in the State House that specifically affects the city of Indianapolis. How did this letter and the participation of these CEOs and VIPs come about?
So yeah, Mason, 2020, what can you even say, right? 2020 brought us a global pandemic in the form of COVID, disrupted the entire world, including the Indianapolis regional economy. We've got a lot of employers that are doing things differently. Entire communities looking at issues like, look at the disproportionate that COVID has had on Black and brown people and people in poverty in the Indianapolis region. There's an unprecedented level of mainstream awareness about systemic racism and racial inequities in our community. And with all of this, you've got a resolve from communities like Indianapolis and others across the country to do things differently and bring about creative solutions to these really urgent problems that the pandemic has highlighted. And in the midst of this, the state legislature's reaction, or I should say members of our General Assembly, have responded with a series of bills that in some cases we think would micromanage local solutions and really limit our ability to bring about creative solutions. In some cases, you've got legislation that would even usurp municipal functions, like the proposal for a state commission to take over the IMPD. And I leave it to Amin from the really from the perspective of a CEO of a growing company that's recruiting a lot of people, both within and from outside Indianapolis. But there's just been a level of frustration and a sense of these changes are hard enough at the local level and require public and private sector and philanthropic sector to collaborate, as we have in Indianapolis for, you know, we've got a 50-year track record of these solutions. This could add another layer. A lot of these legislative proposals, and then part of the frustration is it's not just one proposal, it's several, right? Taking over the IMPD, potentially defunding our public transit system in Indigo, which we've expanded. And it just adds up. It really has boiled over with leaders from many different industries saying, we need to unify and communicate with some of the representatives and senators in the Indiana General Assembly that we're going to oppose this legislation. These are complex problems best left up to local leaders to devise creative solutions.
Yeah. So, Amin, what is the message, the central message that you want the legislator to take from this?
Look, I think, you know, I'm proud of the business and civic and government partnership that we see across Indianapolis and Indiana when it comes to economic development and innovation, et cetera. And, you know, it's the type of community where we always rally together to get things done in the midst of opportunities and challenges. I think the central message is let's direct our energy there. And, you know, whether it's Crawfordsville, Indiana, Fort Wayne, or Indianapolis, those folks closest to the problems, challenges, and opportunities are where the innovation is going to come from to help us push through and find solutions.
So the letter to the legislature casts these examples of legislative overreach, or what it considers legislative overreach, not just as issues of local control, but also as matters of economic vitality. I think it essentially says continuing to try to preempt local decisions or affect local decisions risks stifling the central Indiana economy. I mean, how so?
One of the big shocks of the last 20 years is the war for talent, and regional economies have really become a war for talent. It's always been true to an extent, Mason, but particularly with the rise of tech in Indianapolis, the success of life sciences, what distinguishes a growing city from Indianapolis and a growing economy is its ability to retain, attract, and grow research and development jobs across many industries. Indianapolis has been very blessed. But today, and we think it's going to be even more so when we come out of COVID, creating the kind of city where people want to be becomes so important. The ability to retain our most talented folks and grow our most talented folks here and then attract new depends on having great communities, great neighborhoods, the ability from place to place, which is why mass transit has been huge. Connected places via the bike lanes and the cultural trail has been huge. And so multiple proposals that the General Assembly is offering up would actually limit Indianapolis's ability to do this. You're already seeing hundreds of millions of dollars in new investment happening along our bus rapid transit lines, like the Red Line. Of course, we've got the Purple Line and the Blue Line coming online soon. And one of the proposals cited in the letter would threaten the Blue Line and Purple Line expansion, maybe even give up, you know, $100 million in federal funding for the city of Indianapolis. So a lot of it comes down to the local ability to innovate around creating these great places. They could be public spaces and neighborhoods. And it just requires a lot of creativity. We don't need another layer of state legislative oversight. Now, the other thing I do want to say, though, is it's not as if the state has not contributed to a lot of positive things to this, especially if you look back 20 years. We need a strong state-funded transportation program. We have one in Indianapolis. We need fiscal stability. We have one in the state of Indiana. And so what we would urge state lawmakers to do is focus on those core functions of state government, like transportation, like education, like healthcare, leaving these ability to devise these creative solutions to attract talent to, you know, local leaders here.
So whose idea was it to put this letter together, and who said, you know, what we really need here is to get almost every major employer in central Indiana to sign it? I mean, we need that kind of weight.
Yeah, I'll give the short answer and ask Amin to expand on it. So Indianapolis, 2 million people live in this region, but it's still a big, small town. We've got a very connected business community here. So a lot of it are just conversations that have been taking place since January. There is a new effort that we announced in October of a growing number of companies collaborating on solutions, supporting racial equity, who want to change policies and change their own business behaviors to address these very serious issues of racial inequity in our communities. So it did come out of those discussions, and that's very exciting. Amin, I know you've been having a lot of these conversations among peer CEOs as well.
The number of challenges that we face have never been higher, but also, you know, the level of partnership and participation from the private sector has never been higher as well, right? And I think that what you're seeing is, whether it's COVID, whether it's the aftermath of George Floyd, people relying on each other to get the best ideas on how to navigate, you know, through these areas. And I think there's been this, you know, kind of congealing effect now as we've worked through these challenges, crises, opportunities together. And, you know, there's, I think, a desire to continue to make a difference as a business community. When it comes to, you know, the issues that are most important to Central Indiana or most important to the state. So I think it's, you know, kind of this continuation of this work that we've been doing together to work through COVID, to work through the aftermath of George Floyd, et cetera. You know, I think it's honestly one of the positive byproducts of recent crises.
Was the chamber that, I mean, essentially organized this effort, though?
My perspective, you know, is it honestly a lot of people raising their hand at about the same time, saying, hey, we'd love to have a voice here. And then I think what the chamber was helpful with is helping kind of organize us then, once a number of hands from different pockets of the community were being raised. But I think that's the thing that's pretty incredible about it, is just how organic, you know, this was. Unlike maybe another city where the chamber has to go around making phone calls to get participation, I think it's, you know, we're at literally the inverse of that situation here.
Mason, it was, hey, we've heard this letter is going around, could we sign? And we got that response from literally dozens of folks. So we feel fortunate from that respect.
So it doesn't explicitly say, okay, legislators, we want you to take these bills and throw them in the trash. Is that essentially what you want, though?
Yes, it is. You know, I mean, our organization officially thinks the governor has done a good job coordinating vaccines lately. That's a gargantuan effort, right? We need to continue to build on our transportation systems for interstate commerce, but also just to help get people to work. Oh man, I mean, you could right now, we could name 20 other really high priority issues, just the three of us sitting here, that require a lot of work, a lot of bandwidth from our state government. So yes, we think they've got an important job to do. We're grateful for the leadership that's taken place in the previous years to get us to this point. But yeah, we would urge state lawmakers to focus on those incredibly important core state functions.
I think we can't take it for granted. And I mean, we've got a you know, equal number of threats and opportunities to manage. You know, right now, the world is changing very, very quickly. And honestly, I think from my perspective, there's just a deep desire for, you know, can we just stop getting in our own way, right? And, you know, I look back to a number of years ago where, you know, we're in the middle of an exit process with Apparatus, and literally I'm on emergency phone calls with a publicly traded company about the RFRA situation, trying to salvage our acquisition. Then you fast forward, you know, it's almost ironic. You know, we've just in the process of shifting our headquarters from California to Indianapolis. You know, we exited Canvas to Jobvite. Jobvite was headquartered in San Mateo in the heart of Silicon Valley. We're able to shift another great company to Indianapolis. And then again, right, having to fight the headwinds of a legislature that, you know, wants to tamper with affordable housing, with transit, with things that are of utmost importance to this next generation of talent, right? And I think it's super frustrating, quite frankly, from my perspective. And honestly, I think it doesn't bode well with trying to be a culture where you're focused on what's most important, right? So when you're focused on, you know, making sure Indianapolis can't change its name, when literally I can't remember anybody talking about this issue in the midst of a pandemic, in the midst of rapid digitization, and that's like what we decide to work on today. I mean, it's just absolutely confusing. And we got to stay consistent, right? I think the state legislature in Indiana prides itself on empowering local decision making. And again, I'm just as passionate about this as I would be for Crawfordsville or South Bend or Fort Wayne as I am Indianapolis. I just think it's, you know, we've got to stop the absurdity.
And Mason, you know, the kind of visible wins that have happened even during a pandemic, when state and local lawmakers and business and philanthropy collaborate. We're hosting March Madness, you know, the men's NCAA basketball tournament, entirely in the state of Indiana, exactly where it should be, right? It requires collaboration on multiple levels, right? Great result, 3 straight weeks of media coverage. Elanco's global headquarters is now going to be located at the former GM stamping plant. A better outcome than I could have dreamed in my years, you know, working for the city and things like that. Again, state, local leadership, collaborating with private sector. So, you know, your listeners, you know, can use their imagination in terms of all the possibilities. I think our organization thinks, and a growing number of CEOs thinks, and would urge state lawmakers to focus their energies on those kind of opportunities.
If the legislature doesn't drop these bills, or if it continues to pursue action that would limit the authority of local officials, what can you do? What is the chamber and this coalition planning to do to respond?
There's no doubt that if we couldn't redirect a lot of this energy, get these bills to go away, a growing number of people is going to have to look at the lawmakers that they support in their bids for re-election. And that's what happens. That's how our political process plays out. It certainly would strengthen the resolve of our business organization to take a closer look at candidates that were, in my words, not supporting these kind of creative growth opportunities, that were supporting these more big government micromanaging, in some cases, taking over of municipal functions that we don't think is constructive. But so in a sense, it would just increase our efforts to look at who's running for office and what do they stand for.
The letter doesn't make any mention of politics. In a second, we're going to look at three of the bills from legislators on issues that are referenced in the letter. Now, these three bills all have been authored by Republican state senators who represent districts that include Marion County, Indiana General Assembly, overwhelmingly Republican. And of course, Indianapolis has a Democratic mayor, and the city county council is dominated by Democrats. Do you think the legislative attempts at preempting local control are in some way driven by politics?
Yes, I do. I mean, there's no way around that. And, you know, we know the individuals involved, and, you know, we have relationships with the state senators that you mentioned. Yeah, I mean, you know, in our political system, people try to put points on the board and get wins for their party and get wins for their caucus. I do think, though, it points to a greater philosophical issue about what type of a city and region is Indianapolis trying to build, and what that's going to mean, what types of jobs we're trying to attract. This is not the first time these issues have bubbled up, Mason. We fought the battles on RFRA 5 years ago. It was a PR nightmare for the state of Indiana and the city of Indianapolis. But I do think it just calls into question, who do we want to be? What types of jobs are we trying to attract? What folks are we trying to retain and bring here? Amin, I don't know if you have perspectives.
Yeah, it's like, can we stop the own goals already? You know, like that's the frustrating part. Look, I think the thing about the letter, and I don't know everybody's individual politics there, but I can promise you there's Republicans being represented in the letter that was signed. So I think that bodes well for, I think, you know, Indianapolis politics to that degree. And so no doubt, I'm sure there's some political aspects at play here. But also, I think we, you know, it's back to like, what kind of society do we want to live in, right? Are we open-minded in understanding of differences and of people that don't look or feel like us? And I cracked this kind of joke one time. You know, we're a state and city that will, you know, oftentimes articulate that we're welcoming. And, you know, listen, we're super welcoming to folks that show up for a weekend. But if the food coming from underneath the door smells a little bit different, we're up in arms, right? So I think we got to really figure out the differences between being welcoming for a weekend versus actually being inclusive and tolerant as a society, and understanding that the folks that are on the ground in their local communities are going to be, you know, best representative of the solutions to work through their challenges. And when I say that, you could clip it and put it in a Republican talk track. I mean, that's literally, you know, what we're trying to do with education reform and everything else. So these are not foreign concepts at all to the legislature, right? It's just a convenient amnesia when it comes to the city of Indianapolis.
Well, let's jump into a few of these bills here. So let's start off with Senate Bill 168 that would shift oversight of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department from the mayor to a new 5-member board that would be mostly appointed by the governor. The board would be responsible for any ordinances governing the police department. It would oversee the budget, assume responsibility for the Indianapolis Police Merit Board, and appoint the police chief. So what's the problem there? How does preserving local control there benefit the city?
Police work is really, really hard. Running a metropolitan police department is so complex. And I'm a layperson now. I knew almost nothing about these issues a year ago. Does the state government want to run a metropolitan police department? I mean, that would be the first question that I would have. And Mason, this has been nationally, this has been the subject of intense debate. Communities, not just Indianapolis, are demanding more transparency into how the police carry out policies. In Indianapolis, there have been efforts to create this general orders board with more citizen oversight on police policies. I'm not making a political statement. That's just a fact. Police officers have incredibly difficult jobs. And so I'm still waiting for someone to make a convincing argument as to why a state commission and taxpayers all over the state of Indiana should then be overseeing, you know, a metropolitan police department in a city of almost a million people. You know, this stuff is just really hard.
Is there an economic tangent to that at all? Is that kind of state intervention going to endanger our economy somehow?
I think it could. And here's one thing that I think of. So anyone observing what's happened in America in this past year knows we've got to build trust across communities. I mean, this is impacting the way that I do my job. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, I live in Fall Creek Place, just north of downtown in Indianapolis, and they're friends of ours five blocks away that based on the color of their skin, they've got a very different view of America and terms like economic development and the police than I do. And it's been a huge eye opener for a lot of us, you know, in our own cities and, you know, in our own communities, regardless of where we are. So I'm oversimplifying a very complex issue, but it's really shown a light on our need to build trust within our communities. It's going to be harder to build trust if you've got another layer, say a special state commission, the likes of which has never existed before in our state, overseeing a local function where we need to be having these conversations.
Let's jump to Senate Bill 141, which we've talked about a little bit. It's about public transportation. It would require the state budget agency to withhold income tax revenue from county transit systems if the county failed to raise a certain amount of money on its own. And it specifically, by name, mentions prohibiting Marin County from creating additional Indigo bus rapid transit lines if these revenue requirements are not met. Again, what is the economic argument against state intervention there?
We know that there are lawmakers who have felt that the expansion of mass transit should include fundraising and philanthropy from, you know, the private sector, those employees who are going to benefit and things of that nature. The problem is we feel like the goal line keeps moving on the amounts of money, the types of money, the thresholds that would have to be met. And what this is really about is Indianapolis's ability to compete for federal dollars many more times what's being raised through local referenda. The dollars that, you know, some elected officials want, you know, the corporation to raise are pennies compared to what's at stake and what's possible for us to raise. The referendum, which a lot of people worked hard for, which passed by nearly 60% of the vote, you know, on a night when Donald Trump won the presidency in November 2016, but passed by nearly 60% of the vote. People understood what they were voting for, and they knew that it would give Indianapolis the ability to unlock hundreds of millions of dollars for the build out. We would like those assumptions to hold and to continue down this road and add two more lines of bus rapid transit.
And yet, from a perspective of an employer, does that give you pause on something that would limit public transit?
Oh, I mean, it's totally in the own goal category here, right? So I think it's like, go to college campuses today and go figure out which candidates for jobs are just super excited about driving around town, right? First of all, right? And not to mention the headwind to economic mobility and folks that may not have the privilege of a college education. So yeah, it gives me, you know, great pause. You know, quite frankly, I think the tide ought to turn completely the other direction, which is what could the state be doing to rapidly accelerate our ability to drive economic mobility, retain talent, attract new talent through really progressive mass transit opportunities. It's like a complete out of touchness with literally any trend with regard to the workforce in America, demographics, taste preferences, et cetera. And I think we're further super confused if we think all of a sudden folks are going to have the extraneous disposable income to spend, you know, incredible amounts of money on Uber and Lyft rides, right? It's just a very confused state legislature when it comes to mass transit.
I'm going to switch now to Senate Bill 392, which is about my favorite topic, zoning, specifically in Marin County. This would strip most of the zoning control for Marin County away from the city of Indianapolis and instead break it up between the individual townships and the incorporated municipalities within the county, like Lawrence and Speedway. And Mike, I think when you mentioned placemaking before, that kind of rang a bell for this particular bill. I mean, the ability to control the vibe, if you will, of, you know, an entire area.
Yeah, and it's as much a home rule issue as much as anything, Mason. It's like we've had these laws in place so that communities can set these policies on zoning about the types of development that they want to have close to home. And then also the link to empowering further the townships. We've kind of come a long way since Kern and Shepherd and efforts, you know, as recently as 15 years ago that looked at the duplication and overlap with township governments. So honestly, it's a head scratcher for us in our organization. And again, I think we would just urge the General Assembly to redirect its energy.
So I think the authors and co-authors of these bills are going to say, you know, I am an elected representative of these districts. You know, if I see a problem that affects my constituents, and I think I can come up with a fix, that's my job.
For sure. I mean, I think that's the spirit of our elected democracy. I think the point, though, is if we think legislation and overhead and removing, you know, power from the will of the people and the community is the way to do that, I think it's misguided effort that the way to do it is to be presenting solutions for sure, and then working through partnership and collaboration to get these things done. Why have a city in the first place, right? Like, that's the point of a city? It's rather confusing, quite frankly.
I do want to mention one other bill. This one is about the relationships between landlords and tenants. And it dates back to the last session of the legislature. The General Assembly passed a bill that would block the city of Indianapolis from implementing a series of protections for tenants that the city put in place in 2020. Governor Holcomb vetoed the bill, but earlier this month, the Senate voted to override the veto. Now, that isn't the end of the story. The House, I think, still would have to override the veto in order for the state law to then take effect. Where is the jeopardy in this situation?
We have local controls so that communities can pass these ordinances according to what's appropriate for neighborhoods. We know that these particular renter protections are really important to neighborhoods here in Indianapolis. And again, that goes across racial lines, Mason. It's a time when we need to bring people together and build trust. And it's just another head scratcher as to why some representatives and senators would feel it necessary to take that authority away from the municipality. Credit the governor for vetoing it. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he's probably wondering why should this be a state function? Best I can say is it's just a head scratcher for us.
So just the way that I read the letter and from the conversation that we just had really suggests that interested parties at the state level are completely welcome to work with the city to address these problems instead of passing bills that would preempt local control. But what does that kind of collaboration look like? Are there some examples that, you know, we can give to kind of guide this process?
I think, I mean, one of the best examples is the Indiana Department of Transportation Commissioner Joe McGinnis's willingness to listen to neighborhoods about the north and south split, I-70, I-65. Communities that had concerns a couple of years ago have been heard. The state made adjustments, showed great leadership in that respect. We've got our organization feels is now a better solution. These economic development opportunities, many of which have been brought by the IEDC, Secretary Jim Schellinger, are going to be great for the city of Indianapolis. Again, the way that the IEDC and Mayor Joe Hogsett collaborated on a win for Elanco have been huge. Obviously, within healthcare, getting people vaccinated is so essential. It seems like the state's doing a very good job there. Amin, maybe you can think of others. Those are just three that come to mind.
Yeah, you know, very top of mind examples, right? So what we've been doing for public health as of late, you know, great partnership and collaboration with the IEDC and the city at kind of every level when it comes to, you know, that type of job growth and creation. So, you know, I think there's lots of great examples to point to. I actually think we're a city, you know, and state built on the back of this type of public-private partnership across, you know, city and state lines.
Have you guys heard back from anybody at the legislature yet?
Not yet.
Did you guys like send it to them?
We have conversations all the time. I really think, Mason, my sincere hope is this will give weight to many moderate members of the Republican House and the Republican Senate and will give them some ability to work within their caucuses on more reasonable solutions. And hopefully that, some of these bills will go away. We tried to be very measured in the letter. We tried to not make it a political letter, but it's definitely something that's got a growing number of companies very concerned about our ability to address these really, really urgent problems. We've had a great run as a city the last 40 to 50 years. I don't have to mention all the fathers and mothers of the city that got us here. The strategies that we're going to have to employ 2021 going forward are going to look different, but every single idea that I can think of, and certainly the IBJ and Nate Feltman have talked a lot about, we got to think bigger. We got to think more with more ambition. Every idea that we can think of are ideas that require public, private, philanthropy sectors to work together. And there's not an idea that I can think of that would involve new state agencies kind of taking over local functions, because this work is really hard.
Well, great. Well, let's follow up on this here in a few months, as I know we will, since we're covering the legislature very closely this year. And then we can talk about it in a few months.
Great.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for making the time.
Thanks, Mason.
My thanks again to Michael Huber and Mon Brar. You can find the letter to state legislators in the latest issue of IBJ. It's also the subject of this week's IBJ editorial. And you can check it all out at IBJ.com. And there are a few other strong stories in the latest issue I want to draw to your attention. First up, the law firm Taft, Stantinius, and Hollister is making a big push into public affairs and lobbying in both Indianapolis and Washington, D.C., and has nabbed seven attorneys and non-lawyer professionals, including several big names in Indiana politics, from rival firm Ice Miller to do it. Marilyn Odendahl has the story behind the moves. Also in this week's paper, John Russell explains how a Los Angeles maker of home care medical equipment has quietly picked up stakes, moved to Indianapolis, and become the city's latest public company. And Greg Andrews recounts the recent run-up in shares of Eli Lilly and Company, and explains the ways this new wealth benefits Central Indiana. Again, you can read these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ, or online at IBJ.com. I will say it is quite a bit easier to access all of the latest news and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.